Hello. This is Profiles, and I'm your host, Peter Jacoby. Today, as we welcome into the studio two extraordinary musicians, violinist Jamie Laredo and cellist Sharon Robinson, who also just happened to be husband and wife. Now, I shouldn't say just happened to be. They've been married for 30 years. And for that same length of time, they've been members of a distinguished trio, about all of which we'll converse in the coming hour. That and the fact that the Laredo-Robinson team is now also ensconced in the Jacobs School of Music at Indiana University, where they now serve fortunate students in the string department. I'd like to find out first why, after such outstanding performance careers, they've now decided to focus more heavily on teaching. So what really brought you here to Indiana?
Well, actually, that's easy. Gwynne Richards.
The dean
of the School of Music, who is an extraordinary, extraordinary man, a man of great vision. And he came to see us at our home in Vermont, and we spent an evening with him. And I think after the evening was over, Sharon and I felt, I think we would follow this man anywhere.
So we hope he doesn't leave. Let's keep him here.
I don't think there are any plans for that.
I hope not.
What changes have been wrought in your lives by this?
Well, Indiana's really our home now between September and May during the school year. And we love living in Bloomington, and we really make it our base. We fly in and out of Indianapolis for our concert tours. And, you know, just the responsibility of having these wonderful students it has certainly changed my life, because I haven't done a lot of teaching in the near past. I was at one time at Duke University teaching and in a string quartet, and also at State University of New York in Binghamton for 1 year, but quite a few years ago. So it's been a while since I've made teaching a big part of my life, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
Good. And you, Jamie?
Well, actually, I've been teaching most of my life. Right. I was teaching at the Curtis Institute of Music for 35 years. It's a pretty long time. And frankly, teaching was always a very important part of my life. And so in that sense, nothing's changed. I always found that in the end, in the long run, probably the most important thing that I do is to teach. After all, you know, this is where you can leave something, you can leave a legacy. Playing concerts in the long run is wonderful, and I love it, and I hope to keep doing it. But it's not really as important.
Well, I've heard others say that there is something so gratifying when you're dealing with young people that have the talent and that you can pass on the wisdoms and the techniques. And with your professional backgrounds, there are certainly wisdoms that you can impart. What are some of the things that you tell your students, knowing all that you do about the world of professional music?
Well, I must say, to me, it goes way beyond just teaching the violin and music. I think you have to make the students aware of what awaits them, the difficulties, the struggles, the competition today, which is fierce. We are turning out such extraordinary numbers of wonderful players that, you know, every time there's an opening in an orchestra now for one position for second violin, and you'll have, you know, over 200 or 300 applicants. So to make them aware of all this, and also to try and make them realize how extraordinarily lucky they are to be in music, to be a part of this incredibly noble profession, and to be surrounded by beauty all their lives.
I also try to make my students understand that it's not only music that they have to fill their lives with, but, nature and art and, great movies and so many other, great literature, so many other things that feed their knowledge and their souls so they can have something to say as a musician. I really encourage my students not to just think about music all the time, but really to get out there and live life. And I think I'm succeeding in a little bit.
When you select your students, what are you looking for?
First of all, I am definitely looking for somebody with a lot of innate talent, because if you haven't got that, there's just no hope. It's the competition is so stiff out there that you really have to have a lot of innate talent. But you have to also have the drive and the persistence and just really knowing that is what, you want to do, the vision, that is really what you want to work for, because it takes so much work. And you have to really sacrifice along the way. And you have to know why, and I really look for that definitely in the students that I select for my studio.
And, it's very hard to do that just listening to them play for 10 minutes.
Yes.
So I try very hard to, if there's any possibility of meeting students before and having them play for me privately and talking to them and so on. I do get lots of requests from students all over the country, and I listen to people very often when I'm on tour. They'll play for me in various cities and so on. And I find that for me it's very important also to see if we're going to, if there's going to be a good chemistry there. And because sometimes you can have someone who's a phenomenally gifted person, a violinist, and, he or she just somehow we don't really connect. And that's very natural, very normal. But and sometimes you're surprised. I've been surprised many times, in a good way and in a bad way. So these are all things that are part of teaching.
Do you find as you get into the teaching with a student that you can determine whether a solo career is possible or whether a symphonic career or chamber music? And I know lots of people do all of them, as you do, but is there some guidance in a direction possibly? Or?
Well, in my experience, I have found that, yes, in certain cases, right from the beginning. I have had some students who, when they were 12, 13, I just knew that they were destined to have a great career, and they did. But then again, I have been very wrong many times. I have had students that I thought were going to really have a tremendous career and to have an important career, and then it never happened. Mm-hmm. And then it's been the opposite. I've had students who I really felt, he or she, they're gifted, they're talented, but I don't think they're ever really going to have a life in music. And I've been proven wrong. So, it's very, very difficult to know. It really is.
There's so much serendipity, being in the right place at the right time, people that you meet, that you make contact with, that you strengthen those contacts. And some people aren't good at that, just are not. And some others are. And I think as long as we do our best in instilling this love of music and really just giving them the tools to try and go out and being okay in the business of music, there's not that much more we can do. But we are always getting calls to write letters of recommendation for this and that. So the teaching doesn't stop after they leave the school. The relationship doesn't end.
Oh, it never ends. It really doesn't.
Well, you have a much different relationship than most teachers, where we have classes.
Right. That's right. Exactly.
One-on-one.
This is one-on-one.
When it's one-on-one, they become a part of your family for life, forever. Really do.
Now, one of the things I know that you must deal with is discipline. That's something that you have to get across. What about your own disciplines? How do you keep fresh when you have very busy schedules? What kind of practice regimen do you engage in to keep your playing up to par?
Well, I think both of us like to practice early in the day and really feel good about that, and then teach or travel or rehearse, whatever comes later in the day. But the practicing, for me, it's always best early. Now, there are days when you have to travel at 8 in the morning, and then you practice when you get there. But practicing every day is part of our lives, for sure.
Do it every day. And
absolutely.
How long do you try to?
Depending on the day. Mm-hmm. If there's a day that's totally free, we could do 5 hours or 6 hours or something. But there's many days that that doesn't work out at all. If I can get in a couple each morning and then some more during the day later, that would be great.
I find also that I need at least 3 hours a day. If I don't get it, I'm not happy, and my playing is not happy. so this is, you know, as Sharon says, it's part of our lives. It's just something that we must do every day. And sometimes it's very hard. There are many times when we've had a very long day, either traveling or teaching, and if I didn't get my practicing in the morning, then, you know, I have to practice in the evening from 7 to 10 or whatever. But it's just, it has to be.
Well, let's see what the result of all this practice is. You brought some music with you, and one piece that you thought we might include is some Handel, a Passacaglia. Could you tell me about it, and then we'll let our listeners hear it?
Well, it's a theme and variation. The theme is Handel, the Passacaglia. It was originally for organ. But it's a set of variations by the Norwegian composer, 19th century composer, Johannes Halvorsen. So it's better known as the Handel-Halvorsen Passacaglia.
All right. Well, let's listen to the Handel-Halvorsen Passacaglia as played by Jamie Laredo and Sharon Robinson. We have just heard our guests for today, Jamie Laredo, great violinist, and Sharon Robinson, the equally great cellist, combine in the Handel-Halvorsen Passacaglia. Beautiful stuff.
Thank you.
Let's go way back. Can each of you share with us how music came into your lives? When you were children, where, how it all began?
Well, I was lucky to be born into a musical family. My parents were from Maine and New York and went to Eastman and Curtis, their string players, and got jobs in the Houston Symphony and raised a family there. I'm the oldest of 5 children, and we all play string instruments, and we're all professionals. So I was very lucky to just to start piano at 3, and then I fell in love with cello because I heard the Swan played by the first cellist, who was a woman, very beautiful cellist, Marion Davies. I heard that played when I was about 5 at the summer concerts in the park, and I wanted to play cello, and there was a small, very 8th-size cello in Houston at that time I had access to, so I started cello at 5, and I just fell in love with the voice of the cello, and I'm very happy that that happened because it's a great instrument.
It's a great voice, that instrument.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I was quite different in that my family was not musical at all. However, my father was a fanatic about music. He adored music.
And this was in Bolivia?
This was in Bolivia, yes, in South America. And there was always music in the house. And when I was about five, I believe, he took me to a concert once, and it was a string quartet. And I just fell in love with the sound of the violin. And so I asked him if I could have one of those and play. And I guess I pestered long enough that at Christmas time, I guess when I was five, yeah, that was the year I was still five, they bought me a little violin, and I started taking lessons. And I also just, from the beginning, knew that that was it. Shortly after, when I was not quite seven, my family emigrated to the United States, and I grew up in California, in San Francisco. Music has been my life ever since.
Now, how long was that instrument a screechy one before you turned it into something worth listening to?
Well, I can't tell you that. But apparently it wasn't too long. Apparently, you know, in fact, one of the main reasons that my family left Bolivia to come to the United States was my tea. I was very fortunate in that, you know, this was right after the World War II. So there were a lot of European refugees living all over South America. And my teacher had been a member of the Vienna Philharmonic. He was Viennese, but Italian by birth. And he was a Jew and had to escape Vienna and ended up in Cochabamba, Bolivia. So I was fortunate that I had a good foundation, you know, good teaching from the start. And he encouraged my father very much to bring me to the United States.
South America was filled with refugees.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, when I started to concertize, and I remember my first real long South American tour was in 1960. And I'll never forget going to Buenos Aires, and in those days, this was like one of the great music capitals of the world. They had five major orchestras, and their conductors were Felix Weingartner, Fritz Busch. I mean, you know, really quite extraordinary. And the orchestras were filled with all these extraordinary players.
Mm. Now, one of your early triumphs was the Queen Elizabeth Belgium competition. What did that do for you?
Well, that very much got me started on a career. In those days, this was 1959, there weren't that many international competitions as there are today. Today there are so many. And in those days, to win the first prize in something like that pretty much guaranteed you a beginning. I mean, it wasn't going to guarantee you that you were going to, you know, continue. But it certainly opened up all kinds of doors. And, you know, right away I found myself with a recording contract, and I was playing with all the major orchestras and had management, you know, the works. And it was good and bad for me. Of course, good in that I had all these great opportunities. Bad that it happened, as far as I'm concerned, when I was too young. I was 17. I was 17, yeah. But somehow I was very lucky, and I've managed to survive and been very fortunate in my life ever since.
Well, now, competitions are still important in your life in that you help run the Indianapolis International
Yes.
Violin Competition. Let me ask both of you what value you think there is for students today or for young musicians today to enter competitions. And do you encourage your own students to do so?
Well, I do, because I find that it is a tremendous thing to work for. If you are going to go to a major international competition, the repertoire that you have to cover is huge, and it gives you a goal. It gives you something to work for, and I always tell my students, if this is their attitude, if it's because of this, not because I'm going to win, I think it's a very good and a very healthy thing.
I feel pretty much the same. I do encourage my students to play as much as possible, not only in competitions, but everywhere. Every chance you get to play, I think it's very important, because just sitting in the practice room, you don't really know what your voice is and what your personality on stage will be. So I have all my students play at Meadowood. I have all my students play as much in any master class of anyone who comes. There's the cello department here has cello class every Monday night and every Saturday afternoon, and I want them to play in both of them as much as they possibly can, because you really don't know who you are until you're on stage, I feel.
Now, who handles those
master classes? On the Monday night one, it's shared between several of the cello professors, and the Saturday afternoon is either visiting guests, or usually it's Janusz Starker every Saturday at 12:30.
That's an experience.
It is an experience, and I encourage all my students to go, and if they're not playing, you can learn so much, really.
Sharon, you, like Jamie, lavish your talents on both solo work and ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
Appearing with him in a duo situation, and then in the Kallerstein Laredo Robinson trio. Do you have a preference? Does one activity feed into the others?
Well, I love them both, and playing concertos, and it's not just double concertos that I do, but I do some single concertos, solo cello concertos. I really, truly, truly have loved every second with the trio, that we have just really commissioned so many new works. We've covered all the main repertoire and revisited several times much of the main repertoire, and gone all over the world playing these fabulous trios. And it's been a relationship that's been fantastic, really. I think it's made me much more comfortable on stage in my solo work, which is something wonderful to say. And it's been just so satisfying musically, and to grow with these two fine musicians. It's been a miracle, really, a real blessing. So I've enjoyed that. Probably, if I had to select anything, that would be the meat of my repertoire.
And you've all sort of retained ownership in that group, because all three names are on it, which is unusual.
Yeah,
isn't
we never get a sub.
An ensemble.
Well, you know, many times we've been asked, you know, why, why didn't we get a name? Because I think that we are special in that it's only the three of us who play together. You know, very often a group changes, one person leaves, somebody else comes in, it's still the same group. But for me, it isn't really the same group, because whenever you have a change, it's going to be different. And in our case, we felt that it's the three of us, and if any of us were to decide we didn't want to play anymore, then that's the end
of it.
Mm-hmm. But we've been very, very fortunate, and it's 30 years now, and we're going strong. And we're, I think, really enjoying it and loving it more and more all the time. And I think we're getting better, too.
Talk to me a little bit about that. I mean, the rapport that must exist, 30 years of relationship, of working out music together.
Well, we've seen each other on stage, on tour, in hotels, on flights, delayed flights, terrible, terrible times in airports with storms. I mean, we have been through an awful lot together, and it's only made everything easier for us, I think.
But your understanding of music, too, of a piece of music, working
too.
It through.
The amazing thing is to play, say, a concerto or sorry, a trio by Beethoven, and to put it away and to come back to it 4 years later with these gentlemen has, you know, and that it grows in the same direction, and some of our problems that we had with it have been solved, and that's unbelievable. I don't know how that happens.
Yeah,
but it
does. I don't either, and I can't explain it. And what Sharon said is so true, because very often we will pick up a piece that we haven't played in a few years, and we start playing it, and all of a sudden it's very different. Mm-hmm. But it's different from all three of us in the same direction. It's not like I decided that, oh, we used to play it much too fast and I think it should be much slower. You know, no, it happens that we're feeling it together.
You're really a team.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's very, sometimes it's a little spooky, I'll tell you. But it's been wonderful. And we're also, Sharon and I, well, all right, we're stuck with each other. But we're also very fortunate in the fact that with our pianists, we have had, besides an extraordinary musical relationship, we've had an extraordinary personal relationship. And his family is really like our family. We've watched his kids grow up. He's watched our kid grow up. It's quite wonderful. And we still enjoy being together.
Socially.
When we're on tour, we go out and have dinner together. You know, some people find that amazing.
As members of the trio and otherwise, you've been really strong proponents for new music. You've commissioned things. You've played things. And I wanted to get to an example of that musically. And I understand that something was written for your 25th wedding anniversary mm-hmm. by Richard Danielpour, right?
Yes, so, it's a double concerto in the arms of the beloved.
In the arms of the beloved. All right, tell me a little bit about that, and we're going to hear a cadenza, I think, from there.
It's an extraordinarily beautiful piece, taken on poems by Rumi. And it's a story of a very ancient Persian story of a Romeo and Juliet type situation written many years before Shakespeare. And Richard based this whole piece on that. And it's a very lyrical, very quite beautiful piece. I don't know exactly which part you're going to be playing.
We're going to do the cadenza of dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. But it's a very hauntingly beautiful piece. It ends, the last movement is a very long singing. It's an incredible love duet, which is what he meant it to be, and it really is.
Well, let's listen to some of In the Arms of the Beloved by Richard Danielpour. Our guests are the artists in it, Sharon Robinson and Jamie Laredo. We have just heard a portion of Richard Danielpour's In the Arms of the Beloved, written for our guests of today and played by them. And that would be Jamie Laredo and Sharon Robinson. Beautiful, beautiful music, as you said. I'm amazed by all you accomplish. I mean, a lot of us have busy lives, but you handle full responsibilities of a university faculty member, teaching, committee functions and all. You have busy performing schedules, as soloists and chamber musicians. You, Jamie, also do conducting. You run concert series. You're big on the festival scene, and on and on. I mean, how is all this possible?
Well, sometimes I have to say we get very little sleep, and sometimes it is very difficult. Yes, I feel sometimes very, very much like I'm being torn apart, you know, in this various directions. But then again, I just have to think how incredibly lucky I am to have such a varied life in music. And I can't imagine not having all these things now that I've had them. And I can't imagine just playing trios or just playing concertos or just conducting. It's all one. It's all part of the same thing. And I feel one feeds on another. And
you won't give any of it up.
Well,
we have given up summer festivals. We will go and play a concert or two at a festival, but we don't go and be in residence for weeks and weeks at a festival anymore. We really need to be home and learning next year's repertoire. And we have a lovely, lovely spot in Vermont, and we kayak and garden and swim. And that's really where we recharge our batteries. And we have given up long festivals. We will still be happy to play, you know, at Tanglewood or mostly Mozart or even Aspen if it was just a short stay. But we really must be home, you know, recharging in the summer now.
Yeah, we found that you know, we were spending our summers doing exactly what we're spending our winters doing, and we finally thought, wait a minute, this is, you know, we can't do this. And now we do have wonderful great summers, and our summer home is this wonderful place that we've had in Vermont for many years, and it's a little bit of paradise. Really is.
How much new music do you take on? How many new pieces do you take on a given year, let's say?
You're talking contemporary or just new works?
Just new works for you.
Every year is different. This year we have a brand new piano quartet and a brand new double concerto. And we're revisiting some other pieces, but I don't think there are any other.
But every year we do, and this is something that we made a point of, that every year, not necessarily just a new piece that we commissioned, but a new, to us, old piece. So we're still learning. I mean, there's still some trios, you know, that we haven't gotten to, and we will. And I think it's so energizing to always be learning something new.
It kind of breaks your brain in a way, but I think it's very, very good for us to always be learning new things.
Of course. To you, music is so important. It is your life, in a way. And how do you convey that importance to more people? Because people say that classical music is in decline, that the audiences are graying and that they're getting smaller. I'm not sure I buy all this, but
well,
I'm asking you about that issue.
If I may say, you say you're not sure you're buying this. I know I'm not buying it, because I think this is, I don't know who started this, but it is so not true. I think that there are more people going to concerts than at any other time. As far as the audiences getting grayer, the audiences for classical music have always been
always
great.
Been that way.
I mean, it's just a fact. It's a fact of life. People, for some reason or other, don't really start going to concerts until they're in their 40s or 50s. So it's all just not true. And, I mean, we see this, and I don't understand. It it keeps feeding on itself, that there's a decline in music and there's the audience is getting smaller. Well, that's simply not true. The one thing that I do find is that there are many more concert societies and so on, chamber music societies all over the country, and sometimes they are fighting each other for the funding. And so that, that can be a problem and has been a problem. But as far as the declining audiences and the graying of the audiences, I think it's a bunch of baloney. I'm sorry.
One thing that is true undisputably, though, is that there is no more really wonderful, in many cases, good music in the schools.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
But I think that the orchestras and the chamber music societies are doing so much to go into the schools now. They're making a dent. It's sad to say that, you know, that music is being pushed out in many cases, but I think we all have to redouble our efforts to reach out and try and spread the word that music is there for everyone.
I suppose that's something that your own students could help with.
Absolutely.
Going into the schools.
Absolutely. There are several organizations that accomplish that. There's Young Audiences and, almost, for instance, the International Violin Competition of Indianapolis sends a lot of violinists into schools. Every orchestra sends music into schools, or the schools come to them. So there's, for instance, the Vermont Symphony. They bus in a lot of students for their concerts, and they send chamber music groups into the schools. So the percentage of students in Vermont that are reached by the musicians of the VSO is astounding.
And is the response good?
Is great. The response is astounding. It is just great.
Well, speaking of response, let's go back to some playing on your part. We have one more piece of music. It's from Ravel. Tell us about this. Is the Sonata for Violin and Cello.
One of his masterpieces, really. Every time I play this work, I find something new, something more intriguing. The colors, the complexities. It's a little bit austere because it's just two lonely instruments wandering in this big color scheme of his. But we find it one of the most satisfying duos we play.
We're going to play the second movement of the piece. Any particular comments you have about it?
Yes, it's very difficult.
Okay.
It's a lot of fun, though, when it works.
All right. Well, let's hear what's fun and very difficult. Robinson and Laredo playing the second movement of the Sonata for Violin and Cello by Maurice Ravel. Just heard some ravishing moments by Maurice Ravel from his Sonata for Violin and Cello, the artist Jamie Laredo and Sharon Robinson, who've been in the studio with us today. As teachers engaged with current young students, how do you assess the level of the quality level, their abilities? I think, Jamie, earlier you mentioned that there's a tremendous amount of talent out there.
There is. I find that in all schools all over the country, the level of certainly of string playing is at an all-time high. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary. And therefore, the competition to get in is very, you know, very hard. Indiana is a little different in that we have such a huge school that we have a lot of people who are not only going into performing but into music education. So there's a lot. So here the I would say that the level it's a much broader range. In other words, we have, you know, some incredibly extraordinary players and some that aren't quite. But even on the lowest level, it's really very high.
And would you say that's a difference from the Curtis Institute where you taught earlier?
Well, yes,
Indiana?
Because Curtis is such a small school. I mean, the entire school student body of Curtis is about 150. Here we have, 75 cellists alone?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's a totally different thing. And since Curtis is only the complete scholarship and all that, the people who are there are just absolutely, on the highest level possible. But now, I was a student at Curtis in the 50s, and the level, while again, it was still considered the premier school in the country at that time, the level was nowhere as high when I was a student as it is now.
Really?
Nowhere near. I mean, yes, there were a few outstanding, you know, shining stars, but the level was just much lower than it is today.
And of course, the opportunities that a music student has here with the opera and all the orchestra experience they can get, and the contemporary ensembles and the chamber music. I mean, it's so varied here that you can really find what your forte is, I think, a little bit easier than at some schools because there is such a big banquet to choose from. And each of my students is asking me and asking him or herself, what is it that I am good at? Where am I going to end up? What should I aim for? And they need to be able to sample all these things and really see what they enjoy, what they're good at, and then really focus on that, I believe.
And it is a requirement, isn't it, for them to be an ensemble?
Oh,
absolutely.
And the orchestra must,
absolutely.
Each student.
And, you know, I mean, this school is just so extraordinary in so many ways. I mean, for instance, the opera department is, to me, it's just mind-boggling. This is like a great opera company, you know. And the performances are on such a high level. They're so professional that I don't know any other school in the country like this, really.
But there are so many wonderful composers here, and I have a requirement for each of my students to work with a student composer, a living mm-hmm. composer, writing a piece and performing at the world premiere every year. So, they couldn't do that in many schools. So I think that the opportunities here are there to be had if you really want to sample everything.
What keeps each of you so excited about music?
Music.
Yes.
I think that's it, music.
Music.
Music, and our colleagues are so fabulous, both here at the Jacobs School of Music and just everywhere in the world of music. It's a very small world, really, when you get right down to it. And we are always having fun with our colleagues after the rehearsals and after the concerts.
The thing is, I find that I don't know any other profession. I'm sure there are probably the world of acting is the same way. I don't know. But I don't know of any other profession where no matter what age you reach, you're still trying to improve. You're still trying. You're always reaching for something that is unreachable. I know I can't get there, but I'm trying, and I keep reaching for it. And I think that keeps you young. It keeps you energized. It We're so lucky. We are so incredibly lucky to be musicians. I don't know any other profession like ours. I think we're blessed.
Of course, staying young, being with young people now.
That's another thing. Absolutely.
That also helps.
Absolutely. Being around all these incredible, dynamic young people does keep you young, of course.
So you think there's a magic quality to music?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
No doubt.
Absolutely.
And you're not willing to discover what the elements are. You just want to accept it as a totality.
I don't think it's anything we can analyze or talk about or try. I think it's intangible. I just, it's something there.
Well, it's been wonderful having you in the studio with us today.
Peter.
And I think we've been privileged to spend time with Sharon Robinson, premier cellist, and Jamie Laredo, premier violinist. And you conduct and you do all kinds of things as well. And now you are teachers. We wish you well. And my name is Peter Jacoby, and the program is Profiles.
The program you just heard was recorded in October of 2006. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.